to the Star Trek Retrospective by Film Strip Podcast.
My friends, we've come home.
Our host will boldly follow the voyages and crews of the Starship Enterprise.
It is not logical.
These podcasts will be spoiler-filled as we discuss the plots, characters, and themes of the Star Trek movies.
Neither believe nor doubt.
Now, on with our show.
Make it so.
Welcome back to the Star Trek Retrospective by Film Strip Podcast. I'm Jay.
And I'm Nate.
And today we're talking about Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, starring William Shatner, DeForest Kelly, James Doohan, George Takei, Walter Koenig, Nichelle Nichols, Merritt Buttrick, Robin Curtis, who's that? Christopher Lloyd, and finally Leonard Nimoy. Written by Harv Bennett, directed by Leonard Nimoy. Maybe that's why he was busy. Released in June 1984 on a $16 million budget, grossed $87 million at the box office. So, Nate, we are back here with Star Trek and without Spock, or maybe not. There's an interesting story as to, although we talked a little bit about it on the Wrath of the Khan show, was that late in the process, he decided like, oh, I might come back. And so they, you know, came up with an out for themselves. But do you know how much they knew or Harv Bennett had in mind about how to resurrect Spock after he killed him off?
Well, I think they had that idea at the end of Star Trek II when they added that last few seconds there, like, we'll figure it out. And this could be a way we could do it. But I think they had to think through the process when the film was made. I mean, it was all going to be tied to Genesis.
Yeah, I mean, and like we talked about last time, parts 2, 3, and 4 here make up a pretty close trilogy of Star Wars episodes. They carry forward things to them, but as far as having like actual sequels versus being part of a universe and a series, this is another thing that differentiates Star Trek in a lot of ways from Star Wars, because they're all sequels and sequential and stuff like that. But these tend to be able to stand alone a little bit, but these middle three here, 2, 3, and 4, as it were, do kind of live in a universe where they're dependent upon you knowing something about the other one.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you really can't watch 3 or 4 without having watched 2 or 3. I mean, they literally pick up the minute that the other one leaves off. I mean, we see the beginning of this film and you got the sad music playing. You still see the damage the Enterprise has taken from the Reliant, from their battle with Khan. And it's a solemn atmosphere on the ship. But have you not watched Star Trek II? It would be really confusing. Like, well, wow, I thought Star Trek's supposed to be uplifting and everybody seems really sad.
Yeah, everything sucks. What happened?
Yeah.
I mean, and that's kind of where they leave us. And, you know, a lot of times writers from one movie to the next, even if they continue, and sometimes they, you know, they don't in a movie series and franchise, they just have to pick up what's there. But Harv Bennett knew like, okay, well, if I got to have an out for it, how am I going to make it work? And they're going to build it, like you say, around Genesis, and they're going to use that in what I think is a pretty smart way to kind of bring back the character. But also in a way that if you don't ask a ton of questions about it, you're going to be fine. You just kind of have to accept the movie magic of all of it, as it were.
Yeah, exactly. There is some suspension of disbelief that has to happen, but this is science fiction. So,
yeah, indeed, indeed. And I will say this, having rewatched this time, and it's been a long time, Nate. I mean, I saw this a ton growing up. I caught things in the screenplay and in the script that they were dropping that were deliberately like, we are explaining it to you piece by piece. And I'll try to call those out as we get to them. But I thought that was neat. But now, did you see this one in theaters as well?
I did. And I remember my memories of it were, it was interesting because I went with, it was July of 84. And I went with my aunt and my two younger cousins. And they were, the youngest cousin was just irritable the entire time. Didn't want to be there. The older cousin of the two, they're still younger than me, fell right asleep, just gone within the first 5 minutes. Like when the bird of prey declosed, I'm thinking, whoa, that's so cool. He was already out by that point. And so it was kind of frustrating, but I did enjoy the movie quite a bit as a kid. And in fact, what's oddly enough, I know when you ask a lot of Trekkies in the Pantheon, where does this rank? It's pretty far down there. But for a while, that was my, as a kid, up until really college started, that was my favorite. I very much liked it. I liked it for a while better than 4 for reasons we'll get into. But yeah, I did see it in the theater, and I was just as mesmerized by it as I were the two previous films in the theater.
Yeah, I saw this one in the theaters, and then I think when it came on like Showtime or whatever, we ended up recording it, you know, one weekend. And so I wore that VHS out, and we.
Oh, same.
I think my whole family went and saw this, and we just liked it. I think the reason people like this one as a younger person, if I can, you know, venture back and just speak for a large group at once here, is that this one doesn't require a lot of big thought and emotion like the way the last one did. Like that last one's a pretty deep movie when it comes to the relationships and what's going on. And this one just kind of takes you and it's sort of just going to give you a very simple contained story. Boom, we're going to pop you right in. Even if you don't know enough everything, or maybe you don't understand the full dynamic of it, this one's kind of easier to follow. And I think because of that, it makes it a little more attachable. I also think, and we can't play it down too much, we'll get into it as we get into the deeper discussion, but the introduction of the Klingons in such a huge way as this villain to put everything upon in the movie universe, it is, was also another reason to get into this one.
Yeah, no, this was... You know, we see at the beginning of Star Trek Motion Picture briefly the reimagined Klingons, which sets the tone for how the Klingons will be. But this movie really dives into who the Klingons are, their personalities, their behavior, the Klingon bird of prey, which still permeates through the Trek series. Like it went through next. You still saw them in Next Gen. You still saw it in all the, you know, basically most of the rest of the movies. You see them in Deep Space Nine. You see it in Voyager. I mean, it is something that they build upon. They're like, oh, this works. Let's keep that.
Yeah, we'll talk about it. It's a battleship. It's a battle cruiser versus the Starfleet cruisers. They can do battle, but they're built for a lot of other things, right? And they don't necessarily look like they're on attack mode.
Right.
The bird of prey is, by its own name, is on attack mode at all times.
Oh, yeah. And we'll get into later, like, the thought concept behind that, the design of that ship. But it, to this day, still my favorite villain starship of all time. It is... Like, just when you're a kid and you see that ship decloak, you're like, oh, wow.
Yeah, that's not one you're ever going to forget. But I think we need to get into the plot summary here, Nate, and then we'll get into our structure for the podcast. So again, to remind folks, if for some chance you're jumping in here on the third episode, the first two are back in the archives of Filmstrip podcast. Check those out. But I use the Google AI called Gemini now to help with these plot summaries. So because I figured it just sort of fit the motif. So here we go. Following the defeat of Khan, Admiral Kirk and his crew mourn the loss of their friend Spock, whose body now rests in the newly created Genesis planet. His casket torpedo tube passed through the atmosphere before it fully formed, allowing it a soft landing. So they even give us that to know. Dr. McCoy, though, begins exhibiting very strange behavior, stranger than usual, I guess, and reveals that he secretly carries Spock's Katra, or life essence. Determined to save his friend, Kirk rallies his crew and steals the decommissioned Enterprise to return to Genesis, defying Starfleet orders and wrecking the Excelsior along the way. Their mission is further complicated by the Klingons, also seeking the power of Genesis, because word gets around fast in the universe, kids, and led by the ruthless Krug, they pursue after the Enterprise and force Kirk and his crew into dangerous situations. On the volatile Genesis planet, they find a revived Spock. Savick and David, exploring the planet, come across him, but they realize the planet is very unstable, and he is also unstable and in an altered state. As they race against time to help him regain control, the Klingons, who've infiltrated the planet, capture Savick, David, and Spock. They execute David after he tries to save Savick and leads Kirk and company to go to desperate measures. They allow the Klingons to board and take over the Enterprise, but with the self-destruct sequence already engaged. So after the Enterprise is destroyed and most of the Klingon crew, Kirk and company take out the remaining on the planet and board the bird of prey, taking along their ship and escaping before the planet explodes. The remaining crew all rendezvous with others on Vulcan, where Spock's Katra is restored and the adult Spock greets his friends once again as credits roll. That's Star Trek III in a nutshell, and lots to get into. And, you know, we talked last time that Kirk was going to learn a lot about loss, we said, in the last movie. And now this is kind of the next piece of the grieving process. And I think Shatner does some of his best stuff here in the opening bit when he's kind of narrating what's going on. And there's just a gravity to his voice. He sounds genuinely sad.
Yeah, no, mad props to William Shatner. I mean, this was, if you didn't get emotional at the end of Star Trek II when he was giving his eulogy, I think that you're just not human. But this movie, I mean, you don't really hear this talked about, but Shatner really does a good job of being emotional. We learned about the Kobayashi Maru in Star Trek II. Well, now he's really faced the Kobayashi Maru in this one. This is his Kobayashi Maru. And his acting, yeah, right at the beginning, he is the line where the young cadet comes up to him is like, "Will there be a hero's welcome?" He's like, "God knows there should be, because this time we paid for it in our dearest blood." I mean, oof.
Yeah. That and when he's just walking around his apartment, or he's walking around the ship and he's just sort of alone, you know. Yeah. And that's the thing about Kirk, is as much as he is sort of this headstrong lone wolf and stuff, he's a team guy. He's all about people mm-hmm. and the people around him and whatever. And he really, now he is without his right hand. He doesn't have the person he trusted the most of all of these people. And he's empty from it. And I think it's part of it is too, he's sitting there wondering, like, could we have done it a different way? Could I have beaten the test a different way? And that's how Kirk's mind thinks. And you get a lot of it again, just from Shatner. And I know it's, you know, fun to make fun of him, and we have a little fun at his expense over on the film strip show sometimes, but he is giving a really earnest performance in this. And I think that's one thing you could always say about him, is that the man is feeling the feelings when he's acting, and you're going to know what they are, whatever you interpret them to be.
Well, interestingly enough, this is the first film where they really just said, "Gene Roddenberry, you're not allowed in here at all. You cannot come within 100 feet of this." Like, he was never there because of his constant meddling and constant changing. This, I think, is the first movie we see them to have a lot more emotion, which under Roddenberry is like, no, you can't have that. This is supposed to be you're on a spaceship. You and Roddenberry came from a military background and all this structure. Well, now you have to have this. Now you get to see a little more acting, a little more drama, and it comes across. And speaking of Shatner, I got to meet him this past Saturday, got a photo op with him at a GalaxyCon, and it was my first time meeting him. And it was emotional. All the movies and all the episodes and everything just came back all at once in those 10 seconds I had with him. It was amazing. But yeah, when I heard his voice, you know, that was hearing his voice, I think the first thing I thought of was some of the scenes and the lines he says in Star Trek 3 of all the films, believe it or not, because of his acting prowess and because of the emotion he displays. So yeah, it was incredible. And yeah, Shatner does a fantastic job.
I think it's interesting too, that Nimoy's behind the camera on this one. He wanted to direct, he had been directing some things. He wanted to, you know, lean more in that direction. And the fact that he puts a lot of that on Shatner to carry the emotional weight of this, the first, you know, 10 minutes of this movie before we really get into what's going on and everything, it says a lot. And again, to the rest of the cast too, they all look like people that have just attended the funeral, you know, and they have cinematically, like, we know that's just what they're coming off of. So they're heading home, but everything's a mess. And I noticed something that's happening here. And it was one of those things that I had never caught all these years watching this movie. And I realize now how tight Harve Bennett cranked this script is. Early on, Scotty's talking about doing what? Automating things. Should be fully automated by the time we get back. And I'm like, why on earth would you want to do that? And in my head, I'm going like, okay, strategically, if you get in another fight like that and you lose a bunch of people, it would be nice to just flip the switches on, you know, non-essential or secondary systems, so you don't have to lose people in three places or whatever. But on the other hand, I realized, no, this is setting this up to explain to us how four people are going to steal a starship that has what, 1,000 people on it most days.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And you also got to think it's going to be fully automated, because right now that crew, you got to remember, this was still a training crew.
Yeah.
So those who survived are probably traumatized beyond all belief and can't function at this point. I mean, it's already hard enough on the ship's captain/admiral. Imagine how it is for these cadets who just witnessed, like, wow, we were supposed to go for a training cruise and half of us died, and we just saw something horrifying.
Well, and I think too, it's reminding us that Starfleet, while militaristic, is not the military. All right. They are explorers. They are scientists. They are engineers. They're planet, you know, surveyors. They're all these, they're engineers, they're scientists. And they have a captain who's maybe got a little bit of a military background, so that when you get in those situations, you know how to get out of it. And clearly some of them have more of a bend to that, but the cadets in particular at that point would be exactly that. They would be fresh faced people just coming out of the academy, and this is like their internship. Can you imagine? Yeah. I mean, you have interns, Nate, at your job. Can you imagine if, like, the building burned down and they had to get all those archives, like, together?
Oh my God. I would seriously question. Like, I imagine myself when I was an intern, I imagine in a situation where I go and it's supposed to be this happy moment, all of a sudden the building catches fire or somebody's attacking the building or something like that. And I was just like, I don't know if I want to do this career anymore. I'm sure there are a lot of cadets who probably dropped out after that. It's interesting is we talk about the solemnness of the arrival back. We see even how it's affected people back in at space dock. I mean, when the Enterprise is coming in, you see Janice Rand, who used to serve on the Enterprise in the original series, stand up and just shake her head, seeing just how beat up the ship was. And she knew right then, like, this isn't good. And even after the ship docks and Kirk's ready to check out, then he's got something else that he has to deal with. Like, of all places, right when the ship parks in space dock, which is supposed to be the safest spot that you could possibly be in their home, it's time to unpack, and not just physically, but emotionally. And he's got something else he's got to deal with that completely unexpected.
Yeah, there's a disturbance in Spock's quarters, and he goes in there, and you hear, and for years I thought, man, this is a hell of a dub job for an 80s movie or whatever. And now I'm like, no, DeForest Kelly is just doing a hell of a Spock impersonation. And of course he should be able to, he's been around the guy for years. But you talk about like pulling it off when he walks in and he hears, you know, Jim, you know, and all this stuff, and you're going like, oh, no way. And as a kid, I mean, I remember like going, no, you know, I'm just
blown away. Oh, I was the same. I was like,
and then when you see it's McCoy, and he's got the, you know, and McCoy just has the bug-eyed look, and you know, he's just so good at, he's so animated. Anyway, he's just a walking Looney Tune. And the way Shatner reacts to that, it's like two things at once. It's like, oh, don't rip that away from me again. And also, like, what the hell are you doing, Bones? You know, and that's what I wanted to ask you, is this concept of the Katra, and you know, Spock's father comes back and he mind melds with Kirk because he thinks he's got it. When did that, has that ever been introduced before? Or was that an invention for this movie?
That is not. That was also a plot write-in to bring Spock back, but using it in a very Vulcan way. We have not really seen that explored ever since. So this was something, a new plot twist for something like this. You know, and going back to what you're saying about Kirk crossing McCoy, so he's lost his best friend. He's still suffering the wounds from that. And now his other closest friend is tripping out, and he has no reason. He has no idea why. Can't understand the reason why. And so Kirk at this point is like, how much more loss have I got to take? Like, he's not, my other best friend is losing his mind. My best friend just died. I mean, Kirk at this point has got to be completely confused as to where do I go next from here? Where do I go from here? This is not how I wanted my last command of a ship to be. Like, you got to remember, he's an admiral still. So once he's back, they're not giving a command of another ship. He's parked at headquarters. Like, he's going to be the one controlling fleets of ships, but not the one that's actually commanding a ship. So he's got to be stay home, and that being his last command. It's a lot for him to take.
Yeah, no, it is. And I think you're right. Those people, when they're looking at the Enterprise coming back in, and they know it's already an older ship, it's just being used for training cruises now, which is kind of the next step to the end. And then they see how blown to hell it is. Well, of course, you're not going to put any resources into that. You know, like, for Starfleet, you're like, there's no reason to, y'all. We got better stuff now. Like, we'll just use that, and we can build these things really fast, as we will see in the near future. And so they're just like, yeah, you know, we're not going to sweat the, I mean, and everybody kind of knows. And I think even Kirk and his crew know, like, this is it. This is over. Like, everybody's about to scatter and go get other jobs. You know, we'll see some of them doing that throughout this, because they got bills, they got space bills, man. They ain't gonna stop. Yeah. They got work to do. Well, they got pensions to build, and they got careers. This is their livelihood. And for what we know about this world, is when you work for Starfleet, that's like the primo gig, man. You don't give that up. So it's not like they're gonna go back to the farm.
No, and it actually catches, I think, the senior staff off guard when they come back, and the other admiral is there, and he says, okay, you know, the ship's being decommissioned. Like, wait a minute, you know, Reef, because he goes to Scotty, he's like, your talents are going to be great on the Excelsior. He's like, well, if it's okay, I'm just going to stay here for Enterprise refit. It's like, it's not going to be a refit. He's like, what? And even Kirk's like, wait a minute, what do you mean? He's like, this ship's 24 years old. It's her day is done. We got to move on. And it's a complete surprise. So, like, again, here's another loss for Kirk. It's like, now I'm losing my ship. I've lost my best friend. My other friend is not well in the head. It's got to be devastating. It's now it's starting to get to Kirk, like, okay, something's got to be done about this.
Well, I mean, like you say, he's he's dealing with loss on so many levels anyway, Nate. And now it's to the point where he's lost everything. So the desperate things that Kirk is going to do throughout this movie, which, you know, have become kind of parody and hammy and people make, you know, a lot of whatever in context, again, of watching these movies together in the way that we're doing this, you see like, no, this man is on his last nerve. Like this is all he's got left. And when Sarek comes back and he does the whole bit with the Katra or the plot, you know, device, whatever we want to call it. And, but when he does the mind meld and you can tell he's earnestly like searching for his son, cause he wants that back too, even though Vulcans aren't emotional, there's a bond there, you know, Stoics had relationships and, you know, that's kind of where the Vulcans are based off of. Yeah. And so he searches and I love what he tells Kirk and it's not, it comes off like a guilt trip, but I lay some of that on the way that the actor does the lines. I kind of wish he had softened it a little, but that guy just seems like very harsh in the way he speaks. Is when he's telling Kirk, like, you know, how could you not know? This was his essence. This was everything about him. And now he's just everything he was is gone forever. And I'm like, that's such a powerful line. And I hate that it comes off like such a dig at Kirk. It should be more like a, oh, we both have lost something. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it should have been. He was really angry. How could you do that to him? He trusted you. And Kirk's like, he's like, you denied him of his essence, of his very essence, his future. He's like, I saw no future. His dude was radiated to hell and back. Like, what kind of future was there? And it's, you can see Sarek's genuinely confused, but seeing an angry Vulcan is rare. And thinks Sarek is, when you think of, and this is something I thought about many years later, Vulcans live a long time. So you have to figure Sarek was pretty old. He was probably around soon after, not long after the Federation was founded and helping humans, seeing where they used to be a little more barbaric and the thin patience the Vulcans had with them a lot of times that you saw in Enterprise. And so he's still that old guard's like, God, what, humans can't get this right. Like, why do they always have to mess up? So when humans mess something up, it can be a little agitating to a Vulcan who's like, look, we've been guiding you for all this time. You shouldn't be messing up at this point. And for something to be so deeply personal for a human to mess it up, that is just, it's very hard to control your emotion as a Vulcan.
Yeah. And I think in some ways that's good, but like I say, because we know the Vulcans again to be these very stoic, very logical individuals. I wanted that to play more earnest and not angry and more like profound sadness, you know, to me, like, and I'm just saying again, from the outsider point of view, it's one thing to see a Vulcan get angry and realize that, like, well, any logical person could get angry because you know how to make logical people angry is be illogical a lot, like, out of order. Yeah. Don't, I mean, and I'm not even talking about organization, just like, don't be consistent, and that will drive somebody, you know, who's very logic based nuts, you know, because they don't respond well to that.
As somebody who is very logic based, I can absolutely attest to that.
We are speaking the same language. Both of us are, I think we have pretty strong T's in the old Myers-Briggs type of gator scale.
Oh, yeah, very
and,
much.
And
so.
I realize because I work around a lot of F's sometimes too that I have to flex and kind of remember, like, okay, don't, you know, do that. But I try to warn them or at least tell them on the front end, this is how it works. But what I'm saying from Sarek's point of view, what I would have loved to have seen in that was him to play that sad. And I wonder how that would play if he played it like, not crying necessarily, but just on that deeper level of sad. Like, to me, that would have given Kirk and would have given Shatner something to react off of rather than being attacked. It's more like we're both in the misery now. And he understands, like, oh, this is even worse for you because you're hundreds of years old and you just lost your son, you know? Yeah. And, you know, and so it's just, I don't know. I wonder how that would play along the way, but you're right though. The fact that it's, everybody knows that the Enterprise is toast. That's it. And it's, I mean, and it's sudden, man. Everybody's into different jobs, all the stuff, you know. But we get away from that and we introduce the Klingons, and particularly Christopher Lloyd, who at this time did not know. I didn't watch Taxi, you know, growing up or anything. So I didn't know his 70s work. I, like most people my age, found him in Back to the Future and then all the things he's done since. And to see him on the screen and John Larroquette and all these other people just chewing the scenery apart as the mustache twirling villains, I thought Montalban had a gravitas to him, right? These people are like cartoon Satan on the screen.
It is wild. It is, and I absolutely love Christopher Lloyd as Kruge. I mean, he just, nobody, I don't think anybody could have done it as well as he had done it. He was just so, yeah, just so bombastic and out there. I mean, he was a Klingon. I mean, he is. When I think, if somebody asked me, what is your, if a Trekkie asked me, he's like, who is your ideal Klingon? When you think of Klingon, who's the first person that comes to mind? It's Kruge. It's always Kruge, yeah. Because he is just the pure definition of what a Klingon is, the mentality, mm-hmm. that you can still be cunning without being just overly just warrior-like, but you can be a cunning warrior, but just driven by just emotion and just not giving a damn. I mean, just like doesn't even care. When you see whatever, he gets pissed off at some point, and we'll talk about that later, but he does when he gets angry at one of his crewmen. You know, this mm-hmm. is a small crew, so you can't really afford it. He's like, all right, go ahead. You're done.
He disintegrates the one guy. I wanted to ask you, though, just as somebody who knows the original series so much better, how does this relate to the way the Klingons were portrayed on the show?
So the Klingons on the show, a great episode to really, in my opinion, a great episode to really see that Klingon mentality was The Trouble with Tribbles. Because then they get into the bar fight with the Klingons, get into a bar fight with some of the crew of the Enterprise. And the Klingon, you see this like Klingon just nasty. They're picking, they come in, they drink heavy, they're loud. So it tracks. It definitely tracks. And so I could see Kruge being the kind of person that would walk into a bar and just start picking on somebody just to start a fight.
So that answered my next thing, because as a little kid, I just related everything to what I heard in school every day, which was get under your desk when the Russians bomb us, right? So I always thought like, oh, the Klingons are the allegory for Russia, but they're really not at all. But they are pirates, right? And watching it this time, I was like, these are space pirates, and they're a society of space pirates, which is kind of interesting for pirates. But I dig it because everybody's kind of on their own. There's no like chain of command. It's just the command in that little warship. And this guy is like, he's out like profiteering. You know, he's trying to go and find the gold.
I would think I would associate the Klingons more with the Mongols.
Okay.
You know, the Mongols were imperialistic. They had the empires. Mm-hmm. They were rough. They didn't play around. They were the kind of people that would walk into a random bar and start a fight just to show their authority and dominance. They had a central command, but their empire was vast because they had lots of different people doing their own thing, but still recognizing that leadership still relies in a central location. But we're still going to go out and do our warrior mentality and warrior thing in the name of the empire. And you hear Kruge say that a lot of time, you know, what he's doing is in the name of the empire. Cause the whole Genesis thing, he's like, you know, great. The Genesis device, you look down, kids playing at your feet and the Federation flag flying above your head. You know, that's so it's
They see it as another mark of the Starfleet and of that, the human culture just taking over another spot. You didn't have enough with your own planet, your own solar system. Now you got all these other outposts and you're just going to run us out of the way. And I mean, I get that there's a little bit of mongrel there. There's some indigenous, you know, folk that have been, you know, displaced. There's all kinds of things you could pull from this. And what I'm sort of blown away by is we got to figure how much time has passed here. A couple months, maybe, since the last one, because they didn't really go that far away for the whole fight with Khan and everything like that. But it was far enough that they had jumped to light speed and back, right? So let's say they've been gone 2 or 3 months and all this data about Genesis is out there it's out on the space internet, Nate. Like somebody got on Space WikiLeaks and
they have it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's done. And they even got AI to re-record Shatner doing the Genesis narration. Oh,
they haven't been gone long at all. Like, I mean, it's literally at the beginning of the movie. It's literally what, an hour after the end of Star Trek II, and then they arrive back at Spacewalk, and as they're in Spacewalk, that's when you see Kruge, and he comes gets the Genesis tape from Valkyris, which is interesting, I thought, because Valkyris is Romulan, and a Romulan with a human crew selling a stolen recording of the Genesis device to a Klingon.
Yeah.
Now, I will say something with that scene there, that originally what Leonard Nimoy wanted were the bad guys to be the Romulans. Hence, the Klingon Bird of Prey was supposed to be the update to the Romulan Bird of Prey with the bird wings on the underside that you saw in Balance of Terror. And this was the Bird of Prey was supposed to be the update to that. These were supposed to be Romulans. But the producers like, no, people were more familiar with the Klingons. They associate more with the Klingons. make it the Klingon. So this is after they had already designed the ship. So they're like, well, all right, we'll be a Klingon bird of prey then. That was actually originally supposed to be a Romulan bird of prey. They had already established that, well, that's fine because we saw in the original series that the Romulans and Klingons shared technology. They had the same D4 battle cruisers.
I love this idea that there's the shared universe between like the enemies of the Starfleet, right? Or whatever is that, well, we don't like each other, but we're going to tag team up against those guys because that's what the heels do. And I mean, I like that though. I love that there's, and it took me years later to catch that. And I think it may have been some piece of trivia that I read finally that Valkyrs was a Vulcan. Cause I was like, ooh, the female Vulcan looks, you know, kind of alluring, you know, especially as a boy, teenage boy coming up. And I was like, oh, she's Romulan. Oh, they're a different like set of cats. They're very like if the Klingons are the Joker, then the Romulans are like, you know, a little smoother. You know, they're more Burgess Meredith style Penguin and Riddler and stuff versus, you know, the crazy Tim Burton ones.
Yeah, for sure. You know, what's interesting is that scene where Kruge encounters Valkyrs and gets the tape. If you notice in the TV version, like the network version of the scene, they cut out the scene where they destroy the ship.
Yeah, which I think is wild.
Like it just flies away. I was like, that's kind of a big thing to blow that ship up. It really shows just how it really captures that warrior mentality of the Klingons. Cause that was, I remember seeing that as a kid. First of all, I was mesmerized when the Kruge bird of prey decloaks. And then like he gets the tape. He's like, oh, you've seen it. Too bad for you. And so flies around and comes back and blows them all to hell, and it just goes and just flies off. I'm like, dang, this is, thought Han was bad. I don't know how Kirk's going to deal with these guys.
When you have such a high code that you will execute your own person who clearly is like your lover or whatever too, like you're going to blow away your own spy, because why leave a living witness? Because again, nobody can know these things. Which the funny part to that about me though, and I kind of thought it, maybe they're doing like a little bit of sexual politics sort of under the cover here on this, is that he shows it to two of his crew like right after and says, say no one to this. I was like, oh, you'll show it to the boys, but you can't share it with homegirl. I get it. I see what's up. But in my head, I'm like, well, that's part of that. But I think it's also Kruge is like, I'm in command. So what I say goes, and I get eyes on it first. And if I invite you in the room, then that's my discretion to do so. Right. Whereas
and she was not invited into the room.
Yeah. Khan was a man that was driven solely by revenge. Right. And it burned him up. Right. And Kruge is a man that's driven by profiteering, you know? And so to do that, he's got to be a little Neil McCauley from Heat. He's going to burn whatever's coming around that corner. Anyway, no attachments, be ready to walk. And I like this idea of the Klingons being like these master thieves and stuff, like running, or this group of Klingons. So I was like, this, and it's also kind of why they suck at a fight too, because they don't really know what they're doing, but they are ruthless, and they all follow orders to a way that the humans don't do. Right. Even the most loyal people are going to question some of what Kirk does from time to time. And I don't know. I found all of that and that whole introduction amazing. But the thing, the special effect that just I will never forget is the decloaking and the cloaking idea. It's such a cool thing. Yes. And it is a great looking effect, even to this.
It is a really great looking effect. And even the sound that it makes when it's decloaking and decloaking. And it's interesting when they remastered the original series, where it was where the Enterprise stole a cloaking device, in the remastered, they do the cloak like you see it in Star Trek 3, where it just kind of shimmers. I was like, oh, that's so great. The remaster is amazing. But yeah, I love that effect.
And you're right. That sound effect it's just like the transporter beam. Like, you know what that sound is when you hear it. And and there's like an ominous tone to it, you know? And I'll give two credit, man. The soundtrack on this one is banging again. I mean, the Klingon like war music it's like drums and it's thumping. It's very The Barbarian in some ways.
So as a former music major, I will tell you, of all the Trek films, this one was the best soundtrack, absolutely bar none. And when I would play it to some of my other music major friends, they agreed. I had a lot of low brass friends, a lot of friends that played low brass, and them hearing, especially the scene where the Enterprise being stole, where that high brass kicks into these really high notes, they were sitting there like, that's impossible. How do they make that happen? I mean, it is a very, very good soundtrack.
Well, I mean, and James Horner is a soundtrack guru. He's won multiple awards for Emmer and stuff like that. And he borrows his own stuff now, too. Don't lie. Because there's from Part 2 and this that are all over a movie from 1986 that I really love. Little film you might have heard called Aliens. It works in the same way. It's that clanging, you know, percussion with, like you say, the brass, the alternating brass. And it's so, it's just, it gives it such a neat weight and a really cool kind of cold emotion, you know, which is, you know, strings can be a different feeling, right? They can elicit a different thing, but brass has a very, you're being overtaken is what that feels like. And you can't do anything about it. And I relate a lot of that back just in human nature. I'm one of those people who believes, like, no matter where you're from and stuff, like, people's history just passes itself through you in some ways. I think through genetics and lots of other different things. And I think, you know, you think back to, like, olden times, you know, prehistoric, all this stuff, and the way war got done, man, was you marched with horns, you know, and the idea, and if you believe, you know, if you believe in the Bible and things like that, the children of Israel march around a city and blow horns and blow it down, you know, like that, that kind of stuff. It elicits all those type of emotions. And I don't think that's by accident, because Horner himself will tell you that's why he uses so much of those motifs.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. Well, switching gears a second, let's talk a little bit about the lead up to stealing the Enterprise.
Yes.
I mean, that was, boy, talking about putting all your cards on the table. I mean, this is like, note says we'll deal with the consequences later. All of them, like, they know this is the it. Like, this is probably the last thing they're ever going to do, but it's the cause is worthy.
Well, and the idea is, you know, McCoy is out looking for a ship, right? And I love, like, NYPD Blue Star Trek is hanging out at the bar or whatever. The CIA of Star Trek is hanging out at the bar. And he overhears him talking to that. And, man, that's a weird looking alien, man. I mean, or somebody that works at Hot Topic. I don't know. But there's a lot going on with that whole face and the Yoda talk and all the stuff that's happening there. But I love how McCoy is just, he's just belligerent. He's like, I'll go wherever the hell I'll please, you know? And then this guy's sitting him down like, you need to chill out a little bit, Doc. And it realizes, like, and what I'm blown away by that is, like you had said, they haven't been gone very long and there's already, like, bootleg Genesis stuff out there, right?
Oh yeah. So
clearly the intelligence end of the world is out there listening. And they just happened to catch McCoy saying, but they're looking and listening for, like, where's this leaking from? Where's it coming from? I don't know. I loved all that, like, little Jack Ryan part of this movie for a minute, you know, especially when they go there to breaking him out, you know?
At this point, it's so bad. Like, they've done a horrible job keeping this under wraps, because when McCoy's, when the guy who's trying to sell him the starship, he says, you know, I need to know the destination. He's like, you know, it's just somewhere in the Mutara sector. He's like, oh, Mutara section forbidden, permits many, price more. He's like, look, price you name, money I got. He's like, no, location you name, money I name, or else bargain, no. And then he says, all right, damn it, the name of the place is Genesis. And he's like, Genesis, that's Genesis is planet forbidden, allowed is not. And that's when everybody turns around like, what did he just say, Genesis? So it's already, I mean, it's already got people like
That's what's wild. It's like, man, like, again, Starfleet, CNN or whatever was really on it. Like, they had the word out quick about this because everyone knows this is a bad place to be, you know, and you can't talk about it. And I love that, though, about giving the Genesis planet, like, its own character in the movie. Like, it really can't help what it is, but it's almost like the alien in Alien Resurrection. It doesn't really know what it's doing. It's just going to destroy everything. And so, because it's combustible, and we should talk, we've checked in with the remaining crew from Part 2. We haven't talked about David and Savick yet. Well, as I said in the plot summary, they replaced Kirstie Alley with Robin Curtis, whom I only have ever seen in this movie. I don't know who she is or where she's from. She's doing an interesting Kirstie Alley impression. It was a different change what they did with Savick and with David.
Kirstie Alley Savick was my all-time sci-fi crush. And so having Robin Curtis, no offense to Robin Curtis, you know, good job as Savick, but sorry, Kirstie Alley was just spot on. So do you know why they cast Robin Curtis instead of Kirstie Alley?
No, that's what I wanted you to say, because I don't know the reason why. Yeah. I've never looked
it up. So the reason why is, after Star Trek II, a lot of the main characters, when they signed up contracts for Star Trek II, in those contracts, it was like the promise to appeal for future movies at certain rates. Well, Kirstie Alley was not one of those that signed that contract. She just signed a contract for playing Savick in Star Trek II. Well, around this time, her career was starting to take off. And she, when they came back to approach, was like, hey, we'd like you to star in Star Trek III as Savick. She's like, no, yeah, I'll do it, but my costs have basically just like quadrupled. And so her high demands were like, she's like, look, I've definitely, since Star Trek II, I've made a name for myself. I've done a lot more in the 2 short years. Yeah, I need a lot more money. And they're like, oh, you can't make more than most of everybody else. He's like, well, I'm sorry, that's who I am. And so they brought in somebody else. And that's why Robin Curtis came in. You got Robin Curtis for cheap because they're like, who? I mean, her salary is probably next to nothing. And so they brought her in. Side note, I did meet her at a sci-fi convention in Myrtle Beach. She's really nice. I got her autograph downstairs. And she's super nice. I accidentally called her Kirstie Alley. That was a mess. She just gave me this mean look. I'm like, I'm so sorry. She's like, it happens all the time.
I'm sure it does.
Yeah, but it was it was really cool. But yeah, she's not Kirstie Alley. But that recast, but she did have a nice, I did like the dynamic with her and David, though. I will say that.
Yeah, and I'll say that they're playing it off as if maybe they're not in their relationship, but they're definitely like work besties or whatever, you know, because they're exploring the planet together. She's obviously, you know, a science officer in training, which I think is interesting, though, because she was training for command at the during the last movie. And now she's basically doing the Spock job on the Grissom, which I guess is a step up from where she was. But it's like that doesn't seem like the path to command. That seems like more like the path to doing research, and which is, well, it's like teaching versus working in the lab, you know?
Well, there were plans to make either David or Spock. She was supposed to be the mother of either David or Spock's child. That was the original plan. So that's why you didn't really see her moving up in command. Cause I think originally when they started writing, it's like, okay, we want to make sure she's going to have somebody's kid of a main character in the future. But then those plans got scrapped. They're like, well, we've already written her in like this, and talk about somebody who got a short end of the stick later on. My God.
Yeah.
She's such a dynamic and important character. And then she's like, oh, thanks for everything.
They'll piece her out in another movie as it is, but I do like the dynamic, though, like you said, between the two of them working together, and that they're exploring the new Genesis planet, right? And I put it in the plot summary there because Jim and I didn't bother to leave it in, and I thought it was important to note because they bother. It's another one of those Back to the Future script lines. You know, it's the drop the line, we're set it up. Is how in the world is that torpedo tube down there? Well, the atmosphere hadn't formed, so it just soft landed. And I wrote that in my notes, and I was like, I've heard that line because Mary Metrick doesn't have a ton of lines. So when he says things, like, you kind of listen to it. And I remember him saying that, and it never hit me. It's like, oh, they're explaining to us as an audience, this is how this is going to work. Just go with it. And that's what I say. Like, I think as a young person, you can latch into this movie is because it doesn't ask you to make big leaps from where your imagination already goes.
Yeah. Now, one thing that's interesting, the ship that she's on, it has to drive Savick crazy, because here she was training for command. And I'm not going to lie, Captain Esteban of the Grissom, not a very good captain.
He kind of sucks, yeah.
Seemed a little in over his head, because when he was there and they go down to the planet, at one point they're like, what do you recommend we do? Like, he's constantly like, I'm not sure what to do. Let's do this by the book. He comes across as very, very unsure of what to do. Even as a command of a science ship, a small little science ship out at Genesis, and he's still leaning a little heavily on his crew because he's not sure. He always seemed a little over his head to me.
No, I agree with you. I think he is in over his head, and then he really gets in over his head when the Klingons show up, as we'll talk about in a minute. But I love when they first go down to the planet, they see like life evolving very quickly. And they set that up in the last movie, you know, that they were able to do that cave with its own sun underground, as we established in like a day, you know, or whatever, a couple of days. And then they just can keep, you know, cooking things up so quick. And they're going to get to it later about, you know, how that's happening, but we're just left as an audience to kind of go, well, how is all this going so quickly? Right. And it's part of the mystery. It's also like, again, a plot device to, we've got to get Spock back and we don't want teenage Spock. We're going to have a lot of that, but we're eventually going to get Nimoy back in this role. So how do we make that happen? And I love that they set the mystery up that, like, immediately when they open up the casket, he's gone. Right.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you, because I don't know that they tell us, and I don't know that I don't need to know, but I've never fully understood, how did it completely start Spock's life cycle back over from that point? Why not pick him up from whence he died?
So I'm not sure. I'm not going to lie. That's one thing. It's like, okay, so his body is dead, but how did he get reborn?
Yeah, and his soul's not there, because that's his essence. That's the Katra.
Right. So it makes me think that, because you got to think, when they fired his torpedo at Genesis, it was newly forming. So when it went down, whatever was, I think it sort of backed things up a little bit. I think whatever matter that they used in the creation of Genesis affected his body and basically just restarted it. And the only way to restart it was to start again at mm-hmm. Earth and work its way up. I think it's just because it was considered a planet of rebirth, but it also did it rapidly, because you see how fast everything is growing on this planet. I mean, this planet is just newly formed, and yet you've got trees and crops and flowers and everything just quickly, you know, flourishing. And I think that's what had happened there, is that it was almost a bit of a scientific reincarnation.
Well, I think that's exactly what it is. You just hit on it. Yeah. And that has been my theory for a long time, is that Spock's body, but even going through the atmosphere as it was still forming, probably didn't, like, the inside of his body wouldn't have made it. That tube might have made it, but it probably disintegrated, whatever it is. But as we see, this thing can turn microbes into big things very
quickly.
Exactly.
And I think so, that's exactly what it is. Yeah.
It took that. What we see going forward is basically the Genesis reclone of Spock. You know, and the fact that he aged back up in time is—it's obviously for plot reasons, but it's also because of the way the planet's operating, because of the unstable, you know, situation. And I like that, though, and the idea of thinking about that, because I also think this is a little bit of a nod to 2001. You know, going through this, Dave goes through the Stargate, he's reborn. Right. We see that again. Yeah. And I couldn't find any note on it or whatever, but I wonder if, like, either Nimoy or Bennett were, like, fans of that in some way. Because that was a generation of people, like, they would have been young when that came out. And I wonder if they didn't make just a little nod to that, like Space Baby.
I definitely think so, because you gotta think, you could definitely see some 2001 inferences in Star Trek the Motion Picture. And I'm sure they were still heavily influenced by 2001 at that point. So yeah, I think so, for sure.
Either that, or it's the one note Roddenberry got in the door somehow. This one, because it would have been his kind of thing.
Something tells me
probably not, but maybe somewhere along the way that was in. Maybe that's me just being a movie guy and being a Kubrick stan, that I know that. But I revisited the 2001-2010 duology recently, and then while I'm watching these, because it just got me in the mood for it, and I caught that as I was watching this, because I'd seen 2001, and I was like, I wonder if they're kind of doing that again. It's sort of a neat way of thinking about it. But as we've set up, though, the Scotty automation angle is happening. You know, we're starting to set things up. Kirk and company are, you know, going to go, and he goes and asks, he asks, I mean, I'll give him credit. He's going to ask the vice, you know, the chief admiral, hey, can I have it back? Can I just go see what's going on? I just have a feeling. I've got some information. Can I go? And he's like, absolutely not. It's like, under no circumstances. This Genesis thing is a nightmare. It's a political nightmare for us. But because I think he knows, because he's high up enough to know, like, this thing's already out there. We got people selling this on the black market now. We can't have this. And so I love when he comes out and, like, what's the word? The word's no, so we're going anyway. And I'm like, now that's the Kirk we know and love.
Yeah, you knew what he was going to do the minute where Admiral Morrow is dressing him down. He's like, look, you can't do this. This is your career here. If you keep chasing this, this is going to cost you everything you've ever done. So let this go. And you see Kirk just kind of looking to the left, like he's thinking in his head. He's like, he's making up his mind at that point. He's like, I hear you. I had to try. He's like, oh, okay. Oh, well, at least you asked. And he's like, yeah, I hear you. Thanks for the drinks. Like, anytime. And so that's when he says, all right, we're going to go do this thing.
Yeah, exactly. He tells his guys, let's go get this done. And I don't know. Again, I love the way that they go about breaking McCoy out of jail, you know, out of hospital jail, whatever he's in at this point, which kind of reminded me a little bit of how Matthew Broderick gets out of War Games, if you remember that. These movies are only a year apart, so they didn't influence each other. It just reminded me a little bit of it. But I love how, you know, George Takei gets that one great line, little guy. Don't call McTiny. He just flips him over his head because that, you know, fake wrestler or whatever standing there. And and we also, though, like, I wanted to ask you, why the hell did Uhura get left behind in this movie, man? She seemed like she would be important.
So Nichelle Nichols did state later that she was upset that she didn't have a lot of speaking scenes, that she was left behind. But, you know, when she watched it, she realized how impactful her role was. And she loved the line she did. Like she said, you know, it was worth it just having that scene where she threw, you know, Mr. Adventure in the closet.
Yeah. She's like, that was funny.
That it was showing a different side of her that you never saw, where she's like, oh, this isn't reality. This is fantasy. And pulls out the phasers. Like, you like Mr. Adventure? This is enough adventurous for you now?
Well, what I love is that she, you know, he's giving her crap or taking this like into the nowhere job or whatever, but she strategically took it because it's a beaming station nobody pays any attention to. So it's a great place to go. And if you got friends, you're going to sneak out somewhere, this is a great way to do it. It's a good backdoor job. And I like that she's running that angle. And then Scotty, McCoy, Kirk, and Sulu and Chekhov all go and steal the Enterprise, the automated Enterprise. And I'll give this movie credit because they could have made this simple, right? But the fact that they're like backing the truck up and they got to get the door open before the Excelsior comes to block them. I'm like, man, you know, like the last movie got away with having the big space battles and all that stuff. And this is, they're like in the garage pulling this off. So they can't zoom around at each other. They got to like get through it. And I love how they finally get the door open. They take off. And the second that guy hits the warp drive on the Excelsior, the clunkety clunk sound it makes as it breaks. And I'm like, the billions of space dollars that Scotty just wrecked by taking out a few bolts. Wow.
Oh, yeah. Well, and what's interesting about that is the Excelsior is supposed to have transwarp drive.
Yeah, what is the difference? Yeah.
So transwarp is basically almost going warp, but basically you're going warp 10 at that point. Like you can just be anywhere. But it was all experimental. And so they were just like, all right, here we go. We can finally test out the transwarp drive because they're going to go maximum warp. We go transwarp. We're just going to appear right in front of them like in a second. And so, and then Scotty broke it down and it failed. But my theory is that even if Scotty had not broken it down, it would have still failed because transwarp drive still hadn't been done, even in the time of Next Generation. I mean, you only see it once in Voyager, and it led to some crazy consequences. So they still hadn't perfected it 100 years later. So it was very likely would have failed anyway, but they would have still been able to use warp drive and chase after them. So what Scotty did was just basically completely disable the ship. And I did like that, you know, the clunking sound it makes when it's like starting to zoom up. And oh, and side note, the Excelsior class ship, like another, just like the Bird of Prey, still seen in all the Star Trek series, Next Gen. It is the standard ship 100 years later. It is the standard model ship 100 years later.
Yeah, I was going to say, it looks more like what you know is the Next Gen ships and stuff like that. And you get it. You get why, like, it's the new flagship of the fleet, right? They're going to put that out, and that's not going to be Kirk's ship anymore, but he's still going to take the old boat out for one more ride. You know, it's just like, yep, you know, you can get that one, but I've still got a few tricks left in the old girl here. But boy, the Enterprise is looking rough, man. I mean, it's age, yeah, it's falling to bed. She had a rough day. But they get out, and we're going back again to the Genesis planet. At this point, I think David and Savick have found Spock. You know, and they found the teenage Spock. And I love how Savick talks about the way he is basically going through the levels of maturity that a Klingon goes through, and that it's pretty much hell on a boy. And I'm like, yes, puberty is hell on boys. And it's all the metaphor I need, because having gone through it, I'm like, yes, it's awful. But I love how they amp it up to like even worse for him. It's like he's got that. He's got extreme growing pains happening at the same time. And he also doesn't know who the hell he is, which makes
no
him
idea.
Rabid, you know?
Yeah. And so, and the thing is, they're really like, we need to bring him back to the ship. Like, here we are in a snowy desert with cacti around us, but we're like in 2 feet of snow.
Yeah.
Like, we need to bring him back. We need to get him taken care of. We need to do something. And so, again, it goes back to Esteban not being a very good captain. He's like, oh, what about the danger of radiation? And she's like, no, there's no danger of radiation. He's like, I just want to do this by the book. Let me contact Starfleet and see what we should do. And then when they try to contact Starfleet, he's like, oh, the signal's jammed. So if anything, maybe Esteban's incompetence saved Spock and Savick and David at the moment.
They did.
They beamed up to the ship.
Here they'd be dead. Yeah, yeah, they'd have been toast, because the Klingons waste no time going, swat the fly out of the way. And they just swing by, blow it up, and that's it. It's done. Well, I'm like, wow, that's brutality.
Yeah, well, that was also not Cruz's plan. He was furious when the Grissom took one shot and took out the Grissom. He's like, I wanted prisoners. He didn't know they were on the plane. He's like, I wanted prisoners. Yeah. And he's like, lucky shot, sir. And then he blasts his own.
Yeah, he disintegrates his own dude. Yeah, I did like, though, that effect and stuff, because we've seen the phaser effect the last time, because I think that Paul Winfield did it on himself before the earworm, destroyed him or whatever. And I like the fact that he was willing to do that again. And then he looks at the dude next to him like, you take that job now. And the guy's like, yeah, no problem. I will aim much closer next time. But that's when we know, like, they're picking up on the radio signal and they know, oh, there's people on the planet. So they go down to the planet. And this is what you see the Enterprise and Enterprise class ships do a lot. The captain goes down with a boarding party, right? Well, Captain Esteban, again, he sent two other people because he's an idiot, and it's his captain's discretion. In other words, I'm gonna let you do this, but you can tell he didn't really want to go. And so they're down there and they're hot on the trail at that point. And I love how through the conversations, when David finally confesses to Savick what's going on, why is the planet so unstable, like you've got to give me an answer. And he tells that, hey, I took the cheap route. I did the Dan Brown protomatter situation. I did a hydron collider and I grabbed some of that stuff and I threw it in there. And it got us to the end. And I love the way Savick dresses him down.
Like, oh, yeah.
Look how many people you've killed with this. Yeah. Look how many people are dead. And they're captured at that point. So they're going to be dead soon,
Yeah. He's trying to justify. He's like, look, the protomatter was the only answer to some of the problems that we were trying to face. It was the only answer. And he's like, because of your impatience, how many people have died? And you can see he's like, he has no excuse. He can't defend himself.
Well, and I mean, and it lends to his heritage, his father did the same thing. Mm-hmm. How many times?
Yeah. Yeah.
And, exactly. And not saying he's using that as an excuse, but he doesn't. It's just, you see it in him to go like, he's got that same thing, that same push the envelope that Kirk has, and it costs him dearly at this point. And we're getting into the end here, though, or at least the third act, when things really go to hell. And we're gonna battle with the Klingons. We've got prisoners on the ground. Cruz and a couple of his folks go back up when they hear the Enterprise is closing in. He's like, oh, that'll be nice to, I would steal that one too, So they get into a good little fight here, but it's pretty clear that they trade shots with each other, but they can't keep this up all day because the Enterprise is not gonna be able to fight like that anymore. And I like that about this movie, Nate, is that the last one, if it was a sea battle movie at space, right, that they're not going to replay that again for us this time, because the Enterprise is really going to have to deal with the fact that it's not what it used to be. It's got to own those wounds.
Yeah. Well, just real quick, I just want to back up 1 second as we're right before the battle between the Enterprise and the Bird of Prey. You mentioned Spock struggling through puberty and growing so fast. It is infinitely harder as a Vulcan trying to grow up that fast, because as we saw, he's going through Ponfar.
Yeah,
that is the burning of the Vulcan blood, and he is like, it's the toughest thing a Vulcan male has to go through. But imagine it being amplified even more because of how rapid this thing is. So it is just, it must feel like his entire body is engulfed in flames. And there's only one thing that cures Ponfar, and so that, I thought that was interesting, because that could have been something for a future movie. Is like, well, she is pregnant with Spock's daughter. I mean, that would have been.
I think you're onto it. And I've often wondered, and like, is this whole thing like, is she basically like seducing him to calm him down? And, you know, I didn't do any of the reading behind it, but now that you say that, I'm like, it totally plays like that's exactly what she is doing. And it's
exactly what she's
doing. I mean, it's kind of wild. It's almost like it's very scientific in some way, you know, for the Vulcan, like, well, there's one way to fix this. So I can take care of this for him. David, you go over there and watch your snow on fire and I won't deal with this because clearly you're not going to help me with this. But I don't know. It's neat to think about that. I'd never thought about that before, Nate, but now that you say that, man, it makes total sense.
And I still, to this day, keep looking at any Trek series for that little nugget to say, oh, yeah, this is Spock's kid from Savick. I was like, yes, finally, I knew it was true. And I still haven't seen it. Yeah. But yeah, going back to what you're saying about, so Kirk shows up, you got the Klingons are ready to go, but basically, you know, you've got a couple of guys on the planet, but then the Klingons show up, and then they cloak. Now, what's interesting to know is, which I thought was interesting, is that they could see the cloak on the ship. Their cloaking device must have been garbage because they're sitting there like, what is that flying over there? That looks like an electromagnetic surge. And they're like, maybe enough to hide a ship. Oh my God, battle stations. And I thought that was interesting because you never see that at any other time in any series. Even in the original series, you didn't see that.
I think part of that, I've always played that off, is like, that's why this crew has to be together. And maybe this is like their, even if it is their last ride together, which obviously they all think it is, like their careers are over at this point, because he says, you know, I'll get you a good job in whatever fleet we end up serving. So who knows? They're going to be pirates next. But you see like all those years of skill together, when you bring them back together, you're like, oh yeah, I get it. Like it's like watching a, I'll give you a good example. It's like watching a band like the Eagles. Where two or three of the folks in there had pretty big solo careers. You can argue Joe Walsh's, but Henley and Fry had major solo careers stuff. But when they got that thing back together, you're like, yeah, I kind of get it. Like you understand, like, yeah, the way that, I mean, like they're a different thing apart, but then together, man, the band is just the band. Like they can just do things. Well, and even a band like The Band, you know, Levon Helm and Robbie Robertson, and all those guys, like they just had so much talent, you know, like Fleetwood Mac, I could go all day like this, right? All these individual parts were great, but boy, when they were together, there was nothing like it. And the drama was very similar, speaking of Fleetwood Mac and Star Trek. But yeah, I love that they're able to go toe-to-toe, but obviously they can't keep that up all day. And that's when Cruz springs the surprise on him, you know, after his dog's been killed and all his Ghostbusters demon dog
has been exactly
hellhound there. It was a great puppet though. It's a great nasty looking puppet. He's like, I've got three people here and I'm gonna kill one of them if you don't, you know, send over Genesis to me in a minute. And when that minute runs out, he's like, kill one, I don't care which. And I'm like, that's when you know, like, man, this dude is cold. This is the coldest space Bond villain I've ever seen.
And this is when Kirk finally faces his Kobayashi Maru, because he can't save them.
No,
like he's finally, for the first time, faces death. And he's like, wait, give me a chance to talk. He's like, go ahead, kill. I don't care who. And
they're going to kill Savick.
They're going to kill Savick.
Yeah. The switchblade jumps in. Yeah.
And I hated seeing that. And that's, then you see Shatner at his absolute best.
Yes.
I mean, he just stumbles, falls out of his chair. As you Klingon bastards. It's just like, oh, I mean, and the looks on everybody's faces on the bridge, like they've never seen him like that. Like they've never seen Kirk like this. I mean, especially look on Scotty's face is just horrified. Like, oh my God, I don't know what to do. Like, they don't know what to say or what to do.
Let's be real too. How many of them you think knew at that point that was his son? Maybe he had broadcast at that point. I mean, they clearly were hugging and talking. Well,
at the end of Star Trek II, they would have mentioned it.
Maybe he did, but I kind of wondered watching this time. I was like, maybe a couple of them didn't know, and they had to learn it there. And it's Robin Curtis's best line. She's like, David's dead. Like the way she just delivers it, it's just it's very Vulcan. It's very and Shatner gets all the stuff in this movie. He'll get all the flowers for me on this because he is acting his ass off.
Yes, he is.
And I will give a lot of that to Leonard Nimoy, knew how to get that performance out of him. and what to do. I know how to get Bill to give me his best stuff. And he really did. And look, they did it quick. This movie was a fast production, just a little bit more budget than last time. And they were turning this bad boy out. And I mean, that's a talent in and of itself to be able to pull that together. And the way Kurt resolves at the end of that, and he gets himself back up. I love his line there. He's like, "I swear to you, we're not done yet. We're not finished yet."
Oh, he is.
And I was like, "Man, this guy is going down hard." I love it.
Yeah, this is when he's like, "That's it. I don't give a you know what at this point. I'm putting every single one of my chips on the table. I am not going to lose." And so that's, he's like, "All right, fine. Come on over. You can take the ship." Sets and the look again when he said he starts the computer self destruct. You see Scotty's look like. Like even Scotty's like, "Are you kidding me? We're doing this?"
Yeah. By the way, can I say that is a weak? I mean, trust in the 23rd century is something that's a weak password, dog. For your self-destruct system,
it is.
Like your AOL also, password had it better than that,
and it hadn't changed in 20 years because in the original series, "Let this be your last battlefield." That was the self-destruct code.
Oh, I did not know that was a tieback. Yes, that's awesome. That's code. Tremendous. I love that it's got to be three officers. To do it right, and so he's got Chekhov, he's got Scotty, and he's got himself, right? And they're ready, they're gonna blow the whole thing because obviously McCoy can't be trusted to do it at this point. Yeah. And Sulu's got to fly the damn ship and keep him from getting killed. And so, and maybe Sulu's the one over there going, like, "I might actually have a career still, I might get out of this." I don't know, I'm just making that up, but I did love that they set that up. And I love when the Klingons board the thing and they're like, "The computer's talking." What is it saying? And when he puts the microphone, it's like, minimum safe distance. I couldn't find it. That sounds just like the same voice as the computer and Alien. The mother countdown is the same.
It does sound like it's
eerie, but I love that. What would only made it funnier is if it was more like the Hal voice. Like, "What can I do for you, Captain Klingon? You have 4 seconds to live. Three." But I love that counting down. And again, Christopher Lloyd's a big personality anyway as an actor. And he's screaming into nothing. "Get out of there," knowing that there's no way they can.
Yeah.
And dude, what a decision though. Before we talk about the effect and what it looks like. I mean, the ultimate decision is, the only thing I had left in this galaxy is this ship, and I'm about to blow it to hell because it's my last chip to play, right?
Yeah. So it's interesting when they were writing this that other starships self-destruct. The self-destruct originates from the warp core because that guarantees total disintegration of the entire ship.
You basically just melt the reactor down.
That is not what happened in the self-destruct for this one, because if that would have happened, if the warp core would have exploded, it would have obliterated Prugisip. I mean, it would have been completely gone. Like, there would have been nothing. He was too close to the Enterprise. If the Enterprise went up and its warp core exploded, the bird of prey would have been disintegrated as well. So they set it up. It's like, all right, let's make it explode from the bridge and make it like a slow explosion.
Well, I like the idea there, though, too. It's strategy by Kurt. It's like, well, I got to get out of here. So yeah. I can't take my ship, so I'm going to steal theirs. Yeah. but if I blow the warp, everybody's dead. But Kirk's not doing mass suicide. It's like, there's still a way out of this. And so it's, I read it always as like, there had to be chargers, built into the bridge to be able to blow the bridge without blowing the warp core. If you need to do something, but not cause, because again, Starfleet is not a military per se. So they're not trying to cause maximum damage at all times. If anything, they're trying to save lives. So I like that conceit and that idea. That's like, no, fine. We'll blow the bridge. And as we'll see in later Trek, things like the bridge can detach, it's like the whole disc can come loose and stuff like that. And I like that idea that like, okay, this is like its own little part of the ship. So we're just going to blow it up. And man, the effect of them blowing that model up, dude, that's some really, really good work. And I know Nimoy's the director. So he's not directing that stuff. The second unit stuff on this and the effect stuff is really tremendous.
Oh, really? I mean, that just slow disintegration of the Enterprise. I mean, it's for that dramatic effect. Like, this is it. This is the ship you've known for so long. And we're sending this off on a slow goodbye, and it slow but brutal goodbye.
Well, it just creeps. And then all of a sudden, boom, the roof blows off of it.
Yeah. And so then when it goes into the atmosphere and it's coming down like this fireball across the sky, and
yeah,
and Kirk's like, And of course, like, my God, Bones, what have I done? And one of the best lines is like, what you had to do, what you always do, turn death into a fighting chance to live.
Yeah.
And it was pretty powerful. It was, and then you see Crew just sitting on a ship, his head in his hands. And it's, if you know the Klingon mentality, he's not lamenting the loss of his crew. He's lamenting being beaten.
Yeah.
Like, he's just like, how did I not see this coming? How did this happen? Like, now I've got like, what, one person on this ship and two people on the planet. That's it. Like, he's killed most of my crew. I've lost the Enterprise. I had no idea this was coming. He's like, he got beat, and the warrior got beat by somebody that was that he considered inferior. And so he's just like, it's sort of like, imagine a Tyson Buster Douglas fight. Imagine like the way Tyson felt after losing to Buster Douglas. It's just like, I can't believe this. Or yeah, a 16 seed beating a 1 seed in the tournament. How's the one right. seed? You see them like holding their heads in their head. That's exactly the mentality he had.
Yeah, it's
like
a total upset. And that's, again, why he makes the rash decision. He goes down to the planet because he's going to get some good old-fashioned revenge. And Kirk and him have an old man fight. And it's kind of funny to watch now because it's like, yeah, these guys clearly don't know what they're doing and they didn't have good stunt work. But I do feel like it's fitting for Kirk to be able to kick him in the face and knock him into a volcano. I've had enough of you.
That might be the one of the most Shatner lines ever. I have had enough of you.
Oh, but I remember as a kid in the theater, everybody like cheering when that happened.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. I was like,
yes, that's what we wanted at that point. You wanted Kirk to just beat his ass, and he did. And it's what's wild to see is that you've seen Kirk make all these tactical battle decisions, you know, for two movies now, right? But to see him actually get in the fist fight, you know, it's like, wow. Because, you know, in the old original series, I mean, that was the thing. Kirk was a swashbuckler, right? You know, he's a adventure guy. He could always take his shirt off, get in a fight with anybody. Well, you know, he's an older man now. So can he still do it? Yeah, old man still got it, you know? And it's pretty neat to see that go down. And that he tricks the Klingon, rather, into beaming him up because he knows just enough Klingon to tell him to pass up. And so the Klingon's like, oh, yeah, good. They killed everybody. And he brings him upstairs and they take over the ship because he's, of course, the only one left. And they got guns on him and they're ready to go. And I love that whole sequence. I thought that was just, again, it's just pure Kirk being Kirk.
Yeah. Oh, and then he gets, when he gets onto the ship and he captures the ship, and he says, you know, he asks him if he wants to be killed or taken prisoner. He's like, I do not deserve to live. He's like, fine, I'll kill you later.
And John Larroquette in a great early moment.
they're taking over the ship, trying to figure out the helm. And he says, wait, I thought you said you were going to kill me. He's like, I lied. Get to the brig. So,
yeah, no, it's great. But I love how they're figuring out, like, again, these guys are so resourceful. They've been around, you know, the galaxy long enough. Scotty knows just enough Klingon to be able to, like, go that one, push that one. This is how we're going to get out of here. And him and Sulu get the ship out just as the Genesis planet disintegrates and explodes again. And it's like, okay, so for two movies now, we've ended with a big explosion around something that was supposed to usher in this great change. And it's almost like, you know, Kirk on one hand had to walk away from one explosion with his best friend dead. He goes away from this one with the friend back, not really sure he's going to be able to get him all the way back. 'Cause at this point it's Nimoy, you know, he's aged back up and he's lost his son. He's lost his ship. He's lost his career. He's lost. I mean, they've lost everything to go back to Vulcan for this coda. And that's the neat thing about this movie, man, is the way that it ends itself like that. But before we get into that, just, I don't know, just the gravity of, like, when they fly away this time, going like, man, it's never going to be the same, right? The Enterprise is gone. It'd be like, we crashed the, if you're a Star Wars fan, the Millennium Falcon gets blown up and Empire Strikes Back, and now you got to go fight without
it. Yeah, exactly. It's like, where does this can't, Star Trek cannot end this way. Like, there's no way it can end this way. Like, the Enterprise is gone. They're off going to Vulcan, and, you know, what happens next? Like, this can't end this way. And so they get to Vulcan, and it's like, Sarek comes to Kirk and says, you know, thank you for bringing Spock back, but at what cost? Your ship, your crew, your ship, your son. And Kirk's like, if I hadn't have tried, the cost would have been my soul.
Yeah.
And you know, and then the whole log ceremony on Mount Slayer. I will say, visually stunning Vulcan. Like, I feel like that's really where you see Vulcan at its finest. Like, you get to understand just how, what that planet truly looks like. And yeah, it absolutely, oh, it was mesmerizing. Just the large monuments, the large mountains, the red atmosphere. It's just like, oh, it was so good.
I mean, I'll tell you, I equated that to, like, what if you took Stonehenge and the monument heads at Easter Island and, like, the pyramids, and you put them on a planet, you know, at one time.
Yeah.
It's like just these marvels of history and engineering and thought and all this stuff. And it's just in this sort of big, you know, it's all about thought. Like, you just feel it just permeating. Cause I mean, the remaining crew of the Enterprise, all of them, including Uhura, who's flown out there at this point, have all got to be exhausted beyond the telling of it at this point, mentally, physically, emotionally, all of it. They're just worn out. And then they watch this ceremony that they have no idea even existed.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and they don't know if it's going to work. They don't know what's up. And they have to watch the two of their closest people undergo something that it's not just as simple as, like, downloading a hard drive. Like, I got to unscramble Spock's brain from McCoy's brain without damaging McCoy's brain and put it back in Spock's. It's pretty neat. And again, that's what's so neat is this movie's been so big, you know, to come down to this very, like, solemn moment at the end that's not somber, but it's very reverential. It's an interesting choice.
Yeah, no, and it is. And when you finally see Spock come back, he just kind of walks by, because he's still, as we'll see in the next movie, still not quite there. It still takes some time to put it all there. But he finally mutters, like, that he starts to remember. He's like, Jim, you know, that's your name. And yeah, it slowly starts to come back to me. He's like, ship out of danger. And he's like, yeah, it's like, it's slowly coming back. It's like, oh my goodness. And it's, everybody's happy he's back, but they don't realize how little is there. And then there it is. There's the end. It's just like,
it's wild to leave us in that ending, because, you know, like, that can't be it, right? And I don't think at this point they knew, like, we're probably going to make another one. This is going to be successful. You know, they had a formula going here, but we'll talk about it next time. I don't think they had an entire idea of where they were going to go next. They just knew they wanted to do something else. They had to do something now that they had gone to this point where they were beyond anything they had done before. And the Enterprise is gone. Genesis is over. We're done with that story now. Mm-hmm. And now we got everybody back, but what does that mean? Are they, what's that going to look like?
I think that was important for them. And again, like I said, we'll talk about this for Star Trek 4, but I think the writers, like, okay, no more Genesis. We don't want to make this whole thing about Genesis. Let's go ahead and forget all about that. It is briefly mentioned in the next movie, but I think the writer's like, end of that chapter, let's wrap this up. But yeah, the way it ended, I remember when I came home from the movie, I was so excited, because I'm like, mom, Spock's alive, and they're making another movie. I knew it. I was like, the way it ended, like, they're making another movie.
They have to. Yeah, they have to. And that's what's kind of neat about this, I guess, is we're getting into final thoughts and stuff. Like, the lasting legacy and impact of this, obviously, is it wraps up the Genesis story, right? It gets our crew in a different place. But we have really made Kirk deal with it for two movies now in a serious way. And I'm interested and surprised to think, though, or to hear that in Trekkie world, like, three ranks low, because I know the trope is like all the even ones are the good ones. I'm like, I don't know, man. Three's pretty solid in my book.
Three is really solid. It really is solid, but it doesn't. I mean, when you start looking at all the rest, like, I would, in my personal rankings, you know, I would, of the, let's just go with the six, I would go of the original series, I would go 2, 6, 4, 1, 3, 5. And the thing, and honestly think the reason is because I think a lot of Trekkie's opinions, one has gotten better with age, whereas three has not. I think a lot of people look at some of the Shatner overacting in some scenes as bringing it down a little bit. And then the replacement of Savick with Robin Curtis also takes it down a notch. Nobody likes seeing the Enterprise get destroyed. So that's sort of like why Nemesis is so low, because of what happens at the end of that. So I think people's like, okay, was that really necessary? But I think that's, no, like I said, as a kid, even up through Star Trek VI, Star Trek III was my favorite one. But as time's gone on, others have passed it, and I've, you know, rewatched them many, 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 many times, and it's, three's gone down a little bit, but I still love it. It's a very, there's so many things about this movie that I still truly deeply love that have a long lasting effect on me.
I'm with you, and I mean, I could get why people that are big fans of the series and everything don't like some of the things that happen in this, but as, again, just somebody who's the movie watcher of these and likes the movie series of it, I dig it. I dig all of the emotional weight that it carries. I dig the overacting stuff because I think it's warranted. I think it's all paid for, and I like the idea that there's actual cost to things that you don't just immediately get it all back. And we'll revisit that theme in a future episode or two, I'm sure. But I love the idea that, like, no, you got to make some necessary sacrifices and losses, but it was worth it because you got your soul intact, as Kirk is talking about. And that's what, you know, is that, like, well, whatever it is, I mean, what else can't these people get out of? Like, they seem to always find a way, and I'm sure they will. And again, I was left with the same feeling you were. I was like, I know they're going to do another. They got to. It's just too much to do, you know. And we'll talk about what they do with it as we go forward. But I do think it's a neat one in the franchise. And I don't know where I'm going to stick it yet in the initial six. I'm giving myself the freedom to re-rank those, you know, as we get done with them. So I'll revisit that in a bit. But this one's going to be pretty strong for me, man. I like it a lot. I think it's really good. And if you've seen Wrath of Khan and you haven't immediately followed it up with this and part four, like, you're just kind of doing your movie marathon wrong. The other thing is, we should say, this movie's not long. It doesn't ask a lot. It gets in and out in just a little over 90 minutes. That's pretty efficient.
Well, and it's true. And it's, I think another reason why a lot of people rank it low is it's the movie that has to follow arguably the best Star Trek film that a lot of Trekkies like. And before the Star Trek film that non-Trekkies like the best. And you've also gone, I think people got tired of the Genesis story. And I think people were tired. Like, now we've had back-to-back really dark, kind of depressing Star Trek films. And that's not what Star Trek really is about. I think it just, the timing of it. I think if it were a separate story, let's say it happened after Star Trek IV, I think it would have gotten a higher ranking on there. But it was too, you had back-to-back dark, pressing films of loss. You really don't get that, what you really wanted out of Star Trek. And so, as we'll see in the next one, we're like, okay, let's flip gears and let's laugh a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we went with revenge as a motif, now loss is a motif, and so the next move is to lighten it up a little bit, as we'll see going forward. But yeah, it's a strong one for me again, man. I think we both like this one a lot, and I do think, even though maybe some of it hasn't aged well, I do think it's still a good companion piece to part two, and it's definitely it's infinitely watchable and quotable, and it's fun. So good to talk about it here with you, as always, Nate. Thanks again for joining on the show, and thank you to everybody listening who's been joining us on this next leg of the Star Trek Cinematic Universe. You can follow the show's social media at Filmstrip Pod everywhere. If you go to linktree.com/filmstrip podcast, that's links to all of the places you can find the show and all of our stuff. Follow us on our social media, discuss things with us, and share the show where you can. We appreciate the support. Until next time, thank you for listening to Filmstrip.
Thank you for listening to Filmstrip. You can find more episodes on our website, filmstrippodcast.com. The Filmstrip theme music is produced and performed by Frozen Lake 121. All content used or discussed in these podcast episodes is the property of the respective owners and used under the Fair Use Act, Section 504(c)(2), Title 17.